Good morning, all. First case for argument this morning is SMS versus Material Services. Mr. McKay.
Mr. Wadley, Mr. Gibbons, may it please the Court, Kenneth P. McKay for the appellant, Tronics Development Corporation. SMS DMAG AG was voluntarily dismissed from this case prior to the briefing. Tronics Development Corporation is a six-person engineering company in northern Indiana that engineers very, very specific coating apparatus for specialty use, particularly and primarily as related to this case for metals. Material Sciences Corporation is an Illinois corporation publicly traded, and with respect to Tronics Development Corporation, they use these type of coating devices in their manufacturing product lines. The case from the 30,000-foot view really is a matter of contract. It was a diversity case dismissed at summary judgment in the lower court. The case comprises two specific contracts. The relationship between the two contracts is de minimis. The promissory note at issue here was first issued by the parties in November 1996 and was superseded by a second promissory note in December 1997. The purpose of the promissory note was to provide liquidity to Tronics during the initial stages of manufacturing this device for used by Material Sciences Corporation. The device is an electrostatic coater. Basically, what that does is it uses the electrical differential between the substrate and the plenum in the cloud to attract and deposit a very thin coating of a polymer-based paint on sheet steel. The second contract is the license itself for the use of the equipment by Material Sciences Corporation. And it was initiated in 1994. There was a second agreement executed August 1996. And the third agreement, the agreement at issue here, was negotiated by the parties, but was never signed.
But everybody agrees that this third agreement, this is the one that's in the appendix over here, is Exhibit O, right?
Yes, ma'am.
That's the third agreement. Okay, but everybody agrees that agreement does exist between the parties?
Yes, in all fairness, the Material Sciences Corporation, they conceded the viability and enforceability of that contract for purposes of summary judgment. Our position in summary judgment was it was enforceable, notwithstanding the fact that it was executed. There was a memorandum of understanding executed by counsel. And if you look at the chronology of this case, it's clear that that third agreement is enforceable because the second had lapsed in time and the parties had continued to perform. In fact, they had made the Material Sciences had made the payments due under the third agreement.
Right. I'm just trying to simplify. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going around in this case, and if nobody's arguing about whether there's a third agreement, then we can just look to the third agreement, I take it.
This performance is relevant, though, because the performance under an unexecuted agreement goes to the relationship between the parties, which goes primarily to my argument on the enforceability of another oral agreement, an oral agreement to modify that third agreement. And in the context of the performance between the parties, the fact that they performed under an unexecuted agreement is germane to the issue presented to this court, one of the two primary issues.
There isn't much evidence of an oral agreement, though, is there?
Well,
to cancel a note, that is.
No. The note was never canceled, Your Honor. It was superseded by the second promissory note, and the promissory note itself...
No, but you said there was $100,000 was forgiven or canceled or whatever.
The second promissory note incorporates the first specifically and says that first agreement is incorporated in the second. This is the second main issue in this case is there was never a cancellation under the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, it doesn't help.
What you're talking about. You're You're claiming that, I thought you were claiming that $100,000 was of the note was canceled. Is that right?
It was canceled. It was satisfied under the second promissory note. The first promissory note lapsed because it was incorporated in the second. At the time that $100,000 was due, the second promissory note was in effect. We're claiming a modification, not a cancellation. Now, the language in one of the exhibits is a letter from Mr. Escalon that says that that $100,000 is canceled. But that's a layperson's perspective on the operation of an oral agreement that he documented on October 21st, 2001. Now,
well, could I interrupt you for a minute? I mean, you, I think the part that Judge Cuddy is talking about, on page 25 of your brief, for example, you have a section 4. At minimum, the judgment against Taronix must be reduced by $100,000. And then you say, notwithstanding the promissory note claim of Taronix, the payment of $100,000 was still due Taronix under the agreement itself. Why don't you review what you think that $100 was for? Is this that's line 15 stuff that we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, and this is how it works. In June of 2000, Material Sciences Corporation built line 15 in Middleton, Ohio, and they just used that designation, line 15, as a production line, which it was demonstrating the Taronix technology.
And now, so that has nothing to do with the fact whether there were 1, 2, or 30 promissory notes folded into the note that eventually is in place, right? It's just a separate $100,000?
Exactly. And the requirement to pay that $100,000 comes under the technology license and transfer agreement, not under the promissory note.
And that's the point that your opponents say there's no evidence of any agreement to pay $100,000 for that fee, and they have a bunch of other arguments too, including that you already had an obligation to put that line up, as I understand it, and some other things. So maybe you could address where that's almost a third implicit agreement that you're talking about.
Not really, because see, under section 6.4 and 6.5 of the license agreement, Taronix is due royalties for Material Sciences Corporation's use of the equipment, even if it's for their own use. So when Material Sciences Corporation did not retain Taronix to build the Line 15 equipment, Taronix was due the $100,000, and Mr. Escalon said that he would take the $100,000 as a credit against the second promissory note, which was exactly the substance of the first promissory note. So the fact is this $100,000 gets translated into an obligation under the promissory note, but it isn't. It's an obligation under the technology and transfer agreement.
MSC argues under 6.5, and I'm looking at the third agreement at the moment, but I think this is the same in all of them, that what you said is true unless Taronix is unable to manufacture the production equipment, and that there's no showing this record whether Taronix was able, not able, or anything else.
Taronix said they were not interested in building the equipment.
And
because they had other business,
right,
was in effect, and being a small company, they were willing to waive it. But that's a condition precedent to the acceptance by Material Sciences Corporation of the oral agreement recorded by Mr. Escalon on October 21st, 2001. Performed thereafter.
But is there any evidence from MSC's side of this agreement? You can't show that there's an agreement just because one party says there is.
They built Line 15, didn't they?
Yeah, but they might have built it because Taronix said they were unable or unwilling to do so, in which case they had a right to do it without paying you anything.
Even within the statute of limitations, Taronix would write them a letter and claim breach of that agreement and demand the $100,000. Because, again, there was not a showing that they could not. There was an offer by Mr. Escalon they would not.
I don't see where refusing to build the line gives you the right to charge that royalty.
Well, I don't think there was ever a refusal to build the line. As a matter of fact,
didn't you just say that? It was a letter.
No, they declined to. They declined to build the line. Right. Material Sciences Corporation was in a position of saying, we're going to build this equipment. And Tronix was in a position saying, we have other work to do. We can waive those royalties and allow you to build the equipment. When you go to the agreement also requires Tronix to service the equipment at the request of Material Sciences Corporation. And during the pendency of the Line 15 apparatus between October 2001 and when they shut it down in 2002, Tronix performed. And the only way that they were obligated to perform was under the agreement, and they weren't obligated to perform if there was a dispute over who would build that equipment. Mr. Escalon, Tronix Development Corporation, had every right to expect all the way up until April 2002 that the agreement that he recorded unexecuted was being performed by Material Sciences Corporation.
Well, these are all claims that Tronix is making. There's no indication that Material Science ever agreed to anything, is there?
Exactly. There's a he said, he said business, and you have an affidavit of Mr. Edwards on the side of MSC, and you have an affidavit of Mr. Escalon on the side of Tronix, and it's a genuine issue of material fact for the jury to determine credibility of those two witnesses and the enforceability of that oral agreement. That's exactly why we're here, in my view. The second part of this case...
I'm not sure the oral agreement is enforceable anyway. Go ahead.
Well, the oral agreement is enforceable under Illinois law just as it is in every jurisdiction because there's a validating device for it. The validating device is performance.
But your problem is that there are two possible interpretations, only one of which is that there was performance, the other of which is that Tronix was not in a position to provide the production equipment, which, in which case you're in a different situation.
And the situation still goes to the jury.
I don't know. It's the question whether there's an oral agreement, something the judge would look at. The content, I mean, if there... Besides, there's an integration clause in this contract and everything else, isn't there? I mean, you're really kind of going off on this oral agreement stuff pretty aggressively.
And as we've briefed, Your Honor, the integration clause is barred under Illinois law where the performance of the parties validates the agreement.
But your whole case hinges on the question whether there is a dispute in evidence about whether performance did validate.
Not really, because the $100,000 is still owed to Tronix. They didn't get paid it. And like I said, this in the brief, this is the first breach of the agreement in this dispute.
Now, they've also argued you didn't argue this in the district court. Maybe you might want to...
Your Honor, it was argued. It was pled. The $100,000 obligation was pled as part of the obligation under the oral agreement. If the district court says the oral agreement isn't enforceable, it's still an obligation of MSC under the promissory note, which Material Sciences claims is enforceable. The $100,000 is the tie between the promissory note and the technology and transfer agreement that the district court completely overlooked, even though the district court mentions, not only mentions it, but describes it in the district court opinion, describes the $100,000 obligation being due under the promissory note.
Well, now you are confusing me because you said a little while ago that there was that first promissory note, then there was the second promissory note that the first promissory note got folded into, and then I thought you said that the $100,000 relating to Line 15 was just different money, basically. That was an obligation that you thought MSC had to your company and that you wanted to offset that against the total indebtedness that you have. I'll use a general word. And it isn't necessarily something that you had already borrowed money from MSC for.
The $100,000 was not borrowed money. That was the royalties that would have been due under the agreement.
That's right. So it's a different chunk of money, basically.
And Mr. Escalon recorded the agreement in his mind, sent the letter, performed. The $100,000 wasn't paid. He serviced the equipment on Line 15 in April 2002. Material Science Corporation goes, too bad. You're not being paid anything. So the fact in district court, for purposes of notice pleading, MSC was fully aware that the $100,000 was a demand made by Tronix as part of this case. The fact that Tronix was making that claim under the oral agreement is something that is not fact-based. It's a notice pleading. They had noticed that the $100,000 was a demand. And, Your Honor, it's strictly a matter of prejudice when you come to who's going to provide notice of what claim at what time during a lawsuit. And that goes to the other issue about Material Science of Corporation, failure to plead the affirmative defenses of the UCC and the statute of frauds. They can't get a waiver of that failure to plead at this court.
Mr. McKay, I just want to remind you it's your time, but you're into rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McKay. Mr. Gibbons.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Edward Gibbons. I represent Material Sciences Corporation, in addition to Mr. Wadley. I'll start and end with the alleged oral agreement because I think that is the crux of the case. This case...
Well, I'd like to hear something before you finish about returning the patents. I think that's an issue that...
Sure. The agreement...
requires a little discussion.
Sure. Under Section 10.6B is the only section that deals with
You don't have to start with that.
Sure, I can start there. I can move back. But under 10.6B, it's the only section that deals with reassignments of the patents in the contract.
Well, what's the matter with 10.2?
10.2 talks about return of technology, the difference between return and reassignment.
Section 1.12 that says that technology includes patents.
Sure.
Which is not included in the briefs, as far as I can make out.
It's not, but I can explain it, Your Honor. The definition of technology transferred over from the 1994, the 1996 agreements, and in both of those agreements, which had nothing to do with patents because all the patents at that point were owned by Tronix, so you couldn't have reassigned the patents at that point. But what they were talking about in those contracts were all the technical documents, the schematics, the patents, everything of a technical nature dealing with those.
No, but I'm sorry, the definition of technology never changed through the three agreements. I have them all flagged.
That's correct.
Here. So technology has always included patents. And what we're left with, as Judge Cudahy is saying, in Section 10 of the agreement, several of the subparts of Section 10, 10.2, 10.6, are some ambiguities. And you don't want to read one part of an agreement as though another part doesn't even exist. And if you've defined the word technology to include patents, then why don't you what is it in this agreement that suggests that you get these patents for free for the rest of their duration?
Well, we didn't get them for free, and I'll go back to the vestige of the old agreements, but we didn't get them for free. They got reassigned to us under the 1998 agreement. We had to pay $250,000. We also had to pay each year, starting at $350,000 and going down by 80% increments for a five-year period for those patents. And we also had to prosecute those patents for the duration of the patent. So we didn't get them for free. We paid a lot of money to get those patents assigned to us. And then we did exactly what we're supposed to do under the contract. The reason why that language is confusing, potentially confusing, is it was carried over from the 1996 agreement and wasn't stricken out when we started to deal with assignment of patents.
I certainly understand that that's the argument that you would be making. But it seems to me, under 10.2, if the agreement is terminated or expires, you're supposed to stop manufacturing and shall return to Tronix all the technology capable of being returned. Well, there's nothing incapable of reassigning a patent. You can do it. It's not like it's a trade secret that's now out in the open where you just, you know, what's done is done. So it seems to me there's an argument on the opposite side as well, which is why I wonder if further proceedings on this point are necessary.
The contract needs to be read as a whole.
That's what I'm trying to do, including this definition of technology.
And when the 1998 contract was put together, they added 10.6.B because patents were now owned and were assigned to Material Sciences. So
added the last sentence to 10.6.
Correct.
B. The earlier sentences, in effect, read the same. They just speak about reassignment to licensor and licensee.
Right. So under contract construction, what you need to do is if there's a specific section that deals with an issue, it overrides the general principles. Here, this specifically deals with reassignment to patents. The old contracts there was nothing to reassign. So the old contracts, even though they had patents under the technology definition, you could only return physically the patents. You couldn't have reassigned them in the 1996 agreement because material sciences didn't own the agreements, own the patents at that point.
But, you know, you do have two different sections that both speak about terminating the agreement, and actually 10.2 also speaks about if this agreement is expires, if this agreement is terminated or expires. And then the latter section just kind of covers the subset of MSC terminating the agreement for some reason. I think there may be some way of reading all of this together so that the definition of technology applies throughout and that we don't have to assume that the definition of technology has been jettisoned just because of 10.6B.
Well, I wouldn't jettison the whole...
You are jettisoning it part of it. Sure you are.
What I'm saying is we added a specific section. In the record, there's two letters that you'd see. The issue became, in the 1998 agreement, what's going to happen if material sciences goes out of their way and terminates the contract? So they added that part saying, this is what will happen. We'll reassign the patents. That's the only section that deals with reassignments of patents.
And why does it mean that the patents don't have to be reassigned if the agreement expires? I don't see where you're drawing the negative inference from. Does any of those letters say if the agreement just expires and MSC gets to keep them forever?
No, because
it's silent.
Well, I don't know if it's silent on that, Your Honor. It deals with expiration is the only the expiration is the excuse me termination is the only basis for reassignment.
You're reading more into it than is there. It just says if there's termination, then there's reassignment.
Right.
But it doesn't say if there's no termination, then there is no reassignment.
Well, the expiration of the patent, that wouldn't make any sense because if the patent
expiration
expires...
Expiration of the agreement, not the patent.
Yeah, expiration of the agreement wouldn't make any sense because material sciences paid for that specific right. They paid millions of dollars to get the patents assigned to them, and they would be terribly wrong to have to... simply assign them back at the expiration of the agreement.
Except
of course,
that you
they're continuing to sublicense them during this, after the agreement expires.
Well, they own the patents, and they paid for that right. They paid dearly for that right to own the patents. And the only reason they would have to give those back is
forever.
Material sciences terminated the agreement.
Forever because they paid this money?
Yes.
That seems unreasonable to me, but maybe it's possible.
Under the agreement, they paid $250,000 at the outset in 2002, and then they paid $350,000 for minimum consulting fees. And then if you add those payments up through 2003, it's over $1 million in payments plus the $250,000. So that's a lot of money to be paid to give something back simply because the contract expires.
It's just if you entered into that agreement, you know, companies can make whatever agreements they want to. And if 10.2 is read to say if this agreement is terminated or expires, MSC shall immediately cease manufacturing, blah, 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 and shall return to Taronix all the technology capable of being returned. You go back to technology. Technology means the patents. You know, people are grown-ups. If that's the agreement that you entered into, that's the agreement.
Right, but you can't read the 1998 agreement in a vacuum irrespective of the 1994 and 1996 agreements. They also had the same
exact... Why not? Doesn't Illinois follow a four-corners rule?
What I'm saying, you're right, they do. They do follow the four-corners rule. But I'm saying it's a vestige of the old agreement, and in the old agreement it would be ridiculous to return patents that you didn't own. So that was carried over simply from the 1998 agreement.
That's not four corners, though, obviously. You're saying we have to go outside.
It's not four corners. You'd have to go outside the agreement for that. But there, it's in the record, and obviously the judges can look at that. But in 1998, obviously that section was specifically added to deal with what's going to happen if we terminate the agreement. And that's the only section that deals with reassignment, and that's the operative word here, reassignment back, is 10.6B. And so we would continue to argue that the reassignment would only be triggered by termination of material sciences, which would make logical sense.
Can I ask you a question whether anybody wants these patents anyway? I mean, it seems that they were not being commercialized successfully as of the time the events in this lawsuit were going forward.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. Material Sciences is a publicly traded corporation. I'm sure the higher-ups would... say something on that, but I can't speak to
that. I don't want to get you fired. No, I just am wondering.
I don't know that. But going back to the initial issue that you were discussing with the appellant in this case, it seems the crux of the issue here is whether there was an oral agreement somewhere in the middle here. What's morphed here throughout the case is this oral modification of the promissory note seem to turn into a cause of action in and of itself. That's never been pled here, and that seems to be the confusing part, not only for me but for your honors. There's never been a cause of action for $100,000 to build Line 15. If it was, we would have dealt with that appropriately in our answer and probably moved to dismiss it at that point. So that's not even of issue. What is of issue, though, is they're trying to use that alleged oral agreement to modify the promissory note. And what we argued at the trial court level successfully was that's in violation of the UCC, and we still believe that's the case. The trial court didn't even get to the other two reasons, which I think are also very valid, is that there's clearly no oral contract here. It's not definite. It's not certain. We don't have offer acceptance, and we certainly don't have a meeting of the minds. There's no evidence to that extent in the record. Also, he's never dealt with the issue of statute of frauds. The only argument it seems to be made right now is that we've waived that because we didn't plead that as an affirmative defense. But we didn't have to. That would have been an affirmative defense if he hadn't made the $100,000 claim a standalone claim for that. There was no standalone claim for that. So statute of frauds and UCC were not affirmative defenses to the 1998 breach of contract. They were validly argued in the trial court level, counsel didn't address those. So I would argue that they've waived their waiver argument. And we can't even get to whether we have that defense available to us today. I think it's clear under the UCC there should be a writing. It's clear under the statute of frauds that what they're arguing is they gave us a two-year make license. Now, we would suggest that there's certainly no meeting of the minds. We don't even know what that contract entailed. But if you are to believe what counsel's what's selling this court, it's that it was a two-year make license. It clearly cannot be performed in 1 year. And there's no excuse why it should not have been put in writing or else it's void pursuant to the statute of frauds. There has been a lot of discussion with respect to performance, and somehow performance cures all. But as the case we cited, Do Itself versus Passport, it's not the performance of MSC you look at. It's the performance of Taronix that should be looked at to ensure that there was a contract in place. That would be strong evidence that there was a contract. But there was no evidence of their performance. They did nothing, essentially, did nothing. The only thing they did was write a letter somewhere 2.5 years later. So that's not the performance that would get them around the statute of frauds or the UCC, if that's what they're alleging. So we would suggest that for all the reasons stated by the trial court, in addition to the ones that we've brought up in our briefs, that the judgment in favor of Material Sciences on the main claim and on the counterclaim be upheld. If you have any other questions, I don't really have any other further arguments.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gibbons.
Thank
you. Mr. McKay?
Thank you. Just briefly, address a couple of the more salient points. The UCC provision relied upon by MSC clearly pertains only to cancellation and renunciation. It has nothing to do with modification. And clearly the UCC and the provision 801 that I cite, the UCC does not bar the common law from providing blanks or the fill-in portion of blanks. Modification versus cancellation is clearly a distinguishable issue.
They are different, but the policy with respect to promissory notes really gets into the whole question of the law of commercial paper. And the law of commercial paper depends very much on the propositions, what you see is what you get. The idea of an oral modification of a promissory note or a check or anything else goes, I think, quite contrary to the policy of the UCC. That's why it says it needs to be in writing so people know what they're dealing with.
The UCC says cancellation. It says renunciation, and that's clearly a distinguishable principle when you're dealing with paper or with contracts.
Can you think of a single case where a promissory note has been orally modified, a note that is subject to Article 3, and a court has followed that oral modification? I'd be surprised, actually, just given, again, the overall motivation of of Article 3 of the Code.
I can't cite a case, Your Honor. Wouldn't be the first time it was made here, though.
I'd
like to address this UCC and statute of frauds waiver provision. Interestingly, MSC never pled it. They never even argued it until their response. A sir reply wasn't allowed by the lower court. Not only that, but if you drafted the sir reply and asked Judge McCuskey to go read the statute, because the statute says cancellation or renunciation, I think it would be stating the obvious, and I don't think the lower court had to be stated that the UCC doesn't say that. The argument all through that provision was modification. Those are MSC's words. Modification isn't even in that UCC provision. It was a red herring, and unfortunately, the district court chased it. I don't have to brief every point that goes to the district court to show this was clearly erroneous. It has nothing to do with cancellation. Not only that, where is the prejudice for him not having pled the UCC and the statute of frauds? I'm standing here. How can we defend against it when I can't file a sir reply and they don't plead it? The statute of frauds and the UCC are supposed to be pled. If they ask for a waiver, it's the district court that gets to make a waiver, not the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, with respect, my last point, with respect to the patents, it is unreasonable to read this opinion the way MSC does, because everybody here knows that technology follows the patents. If you return technology, you reassign the patents. It does
no
good.
Well, his argument is that they paid a lot up front for the patents. What's your response to that?
Well, they paid maybe about two-thirds of $1 million for a line that they bragged made $2 million
thereafter. Well, I'm just asking, I mean, people do sell patents. They assign patents. Monies are paid up front. You either capitalize it up front or you pay it over 20 years or you do something. So what's wrong with his argument that in this instance, material science has paid for these patents up front?
Fails for the pure essence of this agreement, because nobody can practice the technology without their claim to the patents. They had to cease the claim to the technology. It follows from patent law all the way through to title. The patents are the only way that anybody can practice the technology. And if they had to cease, it makes no sense for them to keep those patents. And yes, SMS DMAG AG was the one that wanted to utilize these patents. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McKay. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.